the total more than minutely. The consequence of this is that variations around the average of the Gaussian, also called errors, are not truly worrisome. They are small and they wash out. They are domesticated fluctuations around the mean. Love of certainties. If you ever took a dull statistics class in college, did not understand much of what the professor was excited about, and wondered what standard deviation meant, there is nothing to worry about. The notion of standard deviation is meaningless outside of Mediocristan. Clearly, it would have been more beneficial, and certainly more entertaining, to have taken classes in the neurobiology of aesthetics or post-colonial African dance, and this is easy to see empirically. Standard deviations do not exist outside the Gaussian, or if they do exist, they do not matter and do not explain much. But it gets worse. The Gaussian family, which includes various friends and relatives, such as the Poisson law, are the only class of distributions that the standard deviation and the average is sufficient to describe. You need nothing else. The bell curve satisfies the reductionism of the deluded. There are other notions that have little or no significance outside of the Gaussian, correlation and, worse, regression. Yet they are deeply ingrained in our methods. It is hard to have a business conversation without hearing the word correlation. To see how meaningless correlation can be outside of Mediocristan, take a historical series involving two variables that are patently from Extremistan, such as the bond and the stock markets, and two securities prices, or two variables like, say, changes in book sales of children's books in the United States and fertilizer production in China, or real estate prices in New York City and returns of the Mongolian stock market. Measure correlation between the pairs of variables in different sub-periods, say, for 1994, 1995, 1996, etc. The correlation measure will be likely to exhibit severe instability. It will depend on the period for which it was computed. Yet people talk about correlation as if it were something real, making it tangible, investing it with a physical property, reifying it. The same illusion of concreteness affects what we call standard deviations. Take any series of historical prices or values. Break it up into subsegments and measure its standard deviation. Surprised? Every sample will yield a different standard deviation. Then why do people talk about standard deviations? Go figure. Note here that, as with the narrative fallacy, when you look at past data and compute one single correlation or standard deviation, you do not notice such instability. How to cause catastrophes. If you use the term statistically significant, beware of the illusions of certainties. Odds are that someone has looked at his observation errors and assumed that they were Gaussian, which necessitates a Gaussian context, namely Mediocristan, for it to be acceptable. To show how endemic the problem of misusing the Gaussian is and how dangerous it can be, consider a dull book called Catastrophe by Judge Richard Posner, a prolific writer. Posner bemoans civil servants' misunderstandings of randomness and recommends, among other things, that government policymakers learn statistics from economists. Judge Posner appears to be trying to foment catastrophes, yet, in spite of being one of those people who should spend more time reading and less time writing, he can be an insightful, deep, and original thinker. Like many people, he just isn't aware of the distinction between Mediocristan and Extremistan, and he believes that statistics is a science, never a fraud. If you run into him, please make him aware of these things. Quetelet's average monster. This monstrosity called the Gaussian bell curve is not Gauss's doing. Although he worked on it, he was a mathematician dealing with a theoretical point, not making claims about the structure of reality like statistical-minded scientists. G. H. Hardy wrote in A Mathematician's Apology, "The real mathematics of the real mathematicians, the mathematics of Fermat and Euler and Gauss and Abel and Riemann, is almost wholly useless, and this is as true of applied as of pure mathematics." As I mentioned earlier, the bell curve was mainly the concoction of a gambler, Abraham de Moivre, 1667 to 1754, a French Calvinist refugee who spent much of his life in London, though speaking heavily accented English. But it is Quetelet, not Gauss, who counts as one of the most destructive fellows in the history of thought, as we will see next. Adolphe Quetelet, 1796 to 1874, came up with the notion of a physically average human. L'homme moyen. There was nothing moyen about Quetelet, a man of great creative passions, a creative man full of energy. He wrote poetry and even co-authored an opera. The basic problem with Quetelet was that he was a mathematician, not an empirical scientist, but he did not know it. He found harmony in the bell curve. The problem exists at two levels. Primo, Quetelet had a normative idea, to make the world fit his average, in the sense that the average, to him, was the normal. It would be wonderful to be able to ignore the contribution of the unusual, the non-normal, the black swan, to the total. But let us leave that dream for utopia. Secundo, there was a serious associated empirical problem. Quetelet saw bell curves everywhere. He was blinded by bell curves, and, I have learned again, once you get a bell curve in your head, it is hard to get it out. Later, Frank Isidro Edgeworth would refer to Quetelesmus as the grave mistake of seeing bell curves everywhere. Golden mediocrity. Quetelet provided a much-needed product for the ideological appetites of his day. As he lived between 1796 and 1874, so consider the roster of his contemporaries. Saint-Simon, 1760 to 1825. Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, 1809 to 1865, and Karl Marx, 1818 to 1883, each the source of a different version of socialism. Everyone in this post-Enlightenment moment was longing for the aurea mediocritas, the golden mean, in wealth, height, weight, and so on. This longing contained some element of wishful thinking, mixed with a great deal of harmony and platonicity. I always remember my father's injunction that in medio stat virtus, virtue lies in moderation. Well, for a long time, that was the ideal. Mediocrity, in that sense, was even deemed golden, all-embracing mediocrity. But Quetelet took the idea to a different level. Collecting statistics, he started creating standards of means, chest size, height, the weight of babies at birth. Very little escaped his standards. Deviations from the norm, he found, became exponentially more rare as the magnitude of the deviation increased. Then, having conceived of this idea of the physical characteristics of l'homme moyen, Monsieur Quetelet switched to social matters. L'homme moyen had his habits, his consumption, his methods. Through his construct of l'homme moyen physique and l'homme moyen morale, the physically and morally average man, Quetelet created a range of deviance from the average that positions all people either to the left or right of center, and, truly, punishes those who find themselves occupying the extreme left or right of the statistical bell curve. They became abnormal. How this inspired Marx, who cites Quetelet regarding this concept of an average or normal man, is obvious. Societal deviations in terms of the distribution of wealth, for example, must be minimized, he wrote in Das Kapital. One has to give some credit to the scientific establishment of Quetelet's day. They did not buy his arguments at once. The philosopher-mathematician-economist Augustin Cournot, for starters, did not believe that one could establish a standard human on purely quantitative grounds. Such a standard would be dependent on the attribute under consideration. A measurement in one province may differ from that in another province. Which one should be the standard? L'homme moyen would be a monster, said Cournot. I will explain his point as follows. Assuming there is something desirable in being an average man, he must have an unspecified specialty in which he would be more gifted than other people. He cannot be average in everything. A pianist would be better on average at playing the piano, but worse than the norm at, say, horseback riding. A draftsman would have better drafting skills, and so on. The notion of a man deemed average is different from that of a man who is average in everything he does. In fact, An exactly average human would have to be half male and half female. Ketele completely missed that point. God's error. A much more worrisome aspect of the discussion is that in Ketele's day, the name of the Gaussian distribution was La Loi des Erreurs, the Law of Errors, since one of its earliest applications was the distribution of errors in astronomical measurements. Are you as worried as I am? Divergence from the mean, here the median as well, was treated precisely as an error. No wonder Marx fell for Quetelet's ideas. This concept took off very quickly. The ought was confused with the is, and this with the imprimatur of science. The notion of the average man is steeped in the culture attending the birth of the European middle class, the nascent post-Napoleonic shopkeeper's culture. Chary of excessive wealth and intellectual brilliance. In fact, the dream of a society with compressed outcomes is assumed to correspond to the aspirations of a rational human being facing a genetic lottery. If you had to pick a society to be born into for your next life, but could not know which outcome awaited you, it is assumed you would probably take no gamble. You would like to belong to a society without divergent outcomes. One entertaining effect of the glorification of mediocrity was the creation of a political party in France called Pugetism, composed initially of a grocery store movement. It was the warm huddling together of the semi-favored, hoping to see the rest of the universe compress itself into their rank, a case of non-proletarian revolution. It had a grocery store owner mentality, down to the employment of the mathematical tools. Did Gauss provide the mathematics for the shopkeepers? Poincaré to the rescue. Poincaré himself was quite suspicious of the Gaussian. I suspect that he felt queasy when it and similar approaches to modeling uncertainty were presented to him. Just consider that the Gaussian was initially meant to measure astronomic errors, and that Poincaré's ideas of modeling celestial mechanics were fraught with a sense of deeper uncertainty. Poincaré wrote that one of his friends, an unnamed eminent physicist, complained to him that physicists tended to use the Gaussian curve because they thought mathematicians believed it a mathematical necessity. Mathematicians used it because they believed that physicists found it to be an empirical fact. Eliminating unfair influence. Let me state here that, except for the grocery store mentality, I truly believe in the value of middleness and mediocrity. What humanist does not want to minimize the discrepancy between humans? Nothing is more repugnant than the inconsiderate ideal of the Übermensch. My true problem is epistemological. Reality is not mediocristan, so we should learn to live with it. The Greeks would have deified it. The list of people walking around with the bell curve stuck in their heads, thanks to its Platonic purity, is incredibly long. Sir Francis Galton, Charles Darwin's first cousin and Erasmus Darwin's grandson, was perhaps, along with his cousin, one of the last independent gentleman scientists, a category that also included Lord Cavendish, Lord Kelvin, Ludwig Wittgenstein, in his own way, and, to some extent, the uber-philosopher Bertrand Russell. Although John Maynard Keynes was not quite in that category, his thinking epitomizes it. Galton lived in the Victorian era when heirs and persons of leisure could, among other choices, such as horseback riding or hunting, become thinkers, scientists, or, for those less gifted, politicians. There is much to be wistful about in that era, the authenticity of someone doing science for science's sake without direct career motivations. Unfortunately, doing science for the love of knowledge does not necessarily mean you will head in the right direction. Upon encountering and absorbing the normal distribution, Galton fell in love with it. He was said to have exclaimed that if the Greeks had known about it, they would have deified it. His enthusiasm may have contributed to the prevalence of the use of the Gaussian. Galton was blessed with no mathematical baggage, but he had a rare obsession with measurement. He did not know about the law of large numbers, but rediscovered it from the data itself. He built the quincunx, a pinball machine that shows the development of the bell curve, on which more in a few paragraphs, True, Galton applied the bell curve to areas like genetics and heredity, in which its use was justified. But his enthusiasm helped thrust nascent statistical methods into social issues. Yes, no only, please. Let me discuss here the extent of the damage. If you're dealing with qualitative inference, such as in psychology or medicine, looking for yes-no answers to which magnitudes don't apply, then you can assume you're in Mediocristan without serious problems. The impact of the improbable cannot be too large. You have cancer or you don't. You're pregnant or you are not, etc. Degrees of deadness or pregnancy are not relevant unless you are dealing with epidemics. But if you are dealing with aggregates, where magnitudes do matter, such as income, your wealth, return on a portfolio, or book sales, then you will have a problem and get the wrong distribution if you use the Gaussian, as it does not belong there. One single number can disrupt all your averages. One single loss can eradicate a century of profits. You can no longer say, this is an exception. The statement, well, I can lose money, is not informational unless you can attach a quantity to that loss. You can lose all your net worth, or you can lose a fraction of your daily income. There is a difference. This explains why empirical psychology and its insights on human nature, which I presented in the earlier parts of this book, are robust to the mistake of using the bell curve. They are also lucky, since most of their variables allow for the application of conventional Gaussian statistics. When measuring how many people in a sample have a bias or make a mistake, these studies generally elicit a yes-no type of result. No single observation, by itself, can disrupt their overall findings. I will next proceed to a sui generis presentation of the bell curve idea from the ground up. A literary thought experiment on where the bell curve comes from. Consider a pinball machine like the one shown in Figure 8 in the PDF. Launch 32 balls, assuming a well-balanced board so that the ball has equal odds of falling right or left at any juncture when hitting a pin. Your expected outcome is that many balls will land in the center columns and that the number of balls will decrease as you move to the columns away from the center. Next, consider a Gedanken, a thought experiment. A man flips a coin, and after each toss, he takes a step to the left or a step to the right, depending on whether the coin came up heads or tails. This is called the random walk, but it does not necessarily concern itself with walking. You could identically say that instead of taking a step to the left or to the right, you would win or lose $1 at every turn, and you will keep track of the cumulative amount that you have in your pocket. Assume that I set you up in a legal wager where the odds are neither in your favor nor against you. Flip a coin. Heads, you make $1. Tails, you lose $1. At the first flip, you will either win or lose. At the second flip, the number of possible outcomes doubles. Case 1, win-win. Case 2, win-lose. Case 3, lose-win. Case 4, lose-lose. Each of these cases has equivalent odds. The combination of a single win and a single loss has an incidence twice as high because cases 2 and 3, win-lose and lose-win, amount to the same outcome. And that is the key for the Gaussian. So much in the middle washes out, and we will see that there is a lot in the middle. So if you are playing for $1 a round, after two rounds you have a 25% chance of making or losing $2, but a 50% chance of breaking even. Let us do another round. The third flip again doubles the number of cases, so we face 8 possible outcomes. Case 1, it was win-win in the second flip, branches out into win-win-win and win-win-lose. We add a win or lose to the end of each of the previous results. Case 2 branches out into win-lose-win and win-lose-lose. Case 3 branches out into lose-win-win and lose-win-lose. Case 4 branches out into lose-lose-win and lose-lose-lose. We now have 8 cases, all equally likely. Note that again, you can group the middling outcomes where a win cancels out a loss. In Galton's quincunx, situations where the ball falls left and then falls right, or vice versa, dominate, so you end up with plenty in the middle. The net, or cumulative, is the following. 1. 3 wins. 2. 2 wins, 1 loss, net 1 win. 3. 2 wins, 1 loss, net 1 win. 4. 1 win, 2 losses, net 1 loss. 5. 2 wins, 1 loss, net 1 win. 6. 2 losses, 1 win, net 1 loss. 7. 2 losses, 1 win, net 1 loss. And finally, 8. 3 losses. Out of the 8 cases, the case of 3 wins occurs once. The case of 3 losses occurs once. The case of 1 net loss, 1 win, 2 losses, occurs 3 times. The case of 1 net win, 1 loss, 2 wins, occurs 3 times. Play one more round, the 4th. There will be 16 equally likely outcomes. You will have 1 case of 4 wins, 1 case of 4 losses, 4 cases of 2 wins, 4 cases of 2 losses, and 6 break-even cases. The quincunx, its name is derived from the Latin for 5, in the pinball example shows the 5th round, with 32 possibilities, easy to track. Such was the concept behind the quincunx used by Francis Galton. Galton was both insufficiently lazy and a bit too innocent of mathematics. Instead of building the contraption, he could have worked with simpler algebra, or perhaps undertaken a thought experiment like this one. Let's keep playing. Continue until you have 40 flips. You can perform them in minutes, but we will need a calculator to work out the number of outcomes, which are taxing to our simple thought method. You will have about 1,099,511,627,776 possible combinations. More than 1,000 billion. Don't bother doing the calculation manually. It is 2 multiplied by itself 40 times, since each branch doubles at every juncture. Recall that we added a win and a lose at the end of the alternatives of the 3rd round to go to the 4th round, thus doubling the number of alternatives. Of these combinations, only one will be up 40, and only one will be down 40. The rest will hover around the middle, here 0. We can already see that in this type of randomness, extremes are exceedingly rare. 1 in 1,099,511,627,776 is up 40 out of 40 tosses. If you perform the exercise of 40 flips once per hour, the odds of getting 40 ups in a row are so small that it would take quite a bit of 40 flip trials to see it. Assuming you take a few breaks to eat, argue with your friends and roommates, have a beer, and sleep, you can expect to wait close to 4 million lifetimes to get a 40-up outcome, or a 40-down outcome, just once. And consider the following. Assume you play one additional round, for a total of 41. To get 41 straight heads would take 8 million lifetimes. Going from 40 to 41 halves the odds. This is a key attribute of the non-scalable framework to analyzing randomness. Extreme deviations decrease at an increasing rate. You can expect to toss 50 heads in a row once in 4 billion lifetimes. We are not yet fully in a Gaussian bell curve, but we are getting dangerously close. This is still proto-Gaussian, but you can see the gist. Actually, you will never encounter a Gaussian in its purity since it is a Platonic form. You just get closer, but cannot attain it. However, as you can see in Figure 9 in the PDF, the familiar bell shape is starting to emerge. How do we get even closer to the perfect Gaussian bell curve? By refining the flipping process. We can either flip 40 times for $1 a flip, or 4,000 times for 10 cents a flip, and add up the results. Your expected risk is about the same in both situations, and that is a trick. The equivalence in the two sets of flips has a little non-intuitive hitch. We multiplied the number of bets by 100, but divided the bet size by 10. Don't look for a reason now, just assume that they are equivalent. The overall risk is equivalent, but now we have opened up the possibility of winning or losing 400 times in a row. The odds are about 1 with 120 zeros after it. That is 1 in 1 novum trigontillion times. Continue the process for a while. We go from 40 tosses for $1 each to 4,000 tosses for 10 cents to 400,000 tosses for 1 cent, getting close and closer to a Gaussian. Figure 10 in the PDF shows results spread between negative 40 and 40, namely 80 plot points. The next one would bring that up to 8,000 points. Let's keep going. We can flip 4,000 times staking a tenth of a penny. How about 400,000 times at 1/1,000th of a penny? As a platonic form, the pure Gaussian curve is principally what happens when we have an infinity of tosses per round, with each bet infinitesimally small. Do not bother trying to visualize the results or even make sense out of them. We can no longer talk about an infinitesimal bet size, since we have an infinity of these, and we are in what mathematicians call a continuous framework. The good news is that there is a substitute. We have moved from a simple bet to something completely abstract. We have moved from observations into the realm of mathematics. In mathematics, things have a purity to them. Now, something completely abstract is not supposed to exist, so please do not even make an attempt to understand Figure 10 of the PDF. Just be aware of its use. Think of it as a thermometer. You are not supposed to understand what the temperature means in order to talk about it. You just need to know the correspondence between temperature and comfort, or some other empirical consideration. 60 degrees corresponds to pleasant weather. 10 below is not something to look forward to. You don't necessarily care about the actual speed of the collisions among particles that more technically explains temperature. Degrees are, in a way, a means for your mind to translate some external phenomena into a number. Likewise, the Gaussian bell curve is set so that 68.2% of the observations fall between minus 1 and plus 1 standard deviations away from the average. I repeat, do not even try to understand whether standard deviation is average deviation. It is not, and a large, too large, number of people using the word standard deviation do not understand this point. Standard deviation is just a number that you scale things to, a matter of mere correspondence if phenomena were Gaussian. These standard deviations are often nicknamed sigma. People also talk about variance. Same thing. Variance is the square of the sigma, i.e., of the standard deviation. Note the symmetry in the curve. You get the same results whether the sigma is positive or negative. The odds of falling below negative 4 sigmas are the same as those of exceeding 4 sigmas, here 1 in 32,000 times. As the listener can see, the main point of the Gaussian bell curve is, as I have been saying, that most observations hover around the mediocre, the mean, while the odds of a deviation decline faster and faster, exponentially, as you move away from the mean. If you need to retain one single piece of information, just remember this dramatic speed of decrease in the odds as you move away from the average. Outliers are increasingly unlikely. You can safely ignore them. This property also generates the supreme law of mediocristan. Given the paucity of large deviations, their contribution to the total will be vanishingly small. In the height example earlier in this chapter, I used units of deviations of 10 centimeters, showing how the incidence declined as the height increased. These were 1 sigma deviations. The height table also provides an example of the operation of scaling to a sigma by using the sigma as a unit of measurement. Those comforting assumptions. Note the central assumptions we made in the coin flip game that led to the proto-Gaussian, or mild randomness. First central assumption. The flips are independent of one another. The coin has no memory. The fact that you got heads or tails on the previous flip does not change the odds of your getting heads or tails on the next one. You do not become a better coin flipper over time. If you introduce memory or skills in flipping, the entire Gaussian business becomes shaky. Recall our discussions in Chapter 14 on preferential attachment and cumulative advantage. Both theories assert that winning today makes you more likely to win in the future. Therefore, probabilities are dependent on history, and the first central assumption leading to the Gaussian bell curve fails in reality. In games, of course, past winnings are not supposed to translate into an increased probability of future gains, but not so in real life, which is why I worry about teaching probability from games. But when winning leads to more winning, you are far more likely to see 40 wins in a row than with a proto-Gaussian. Second central assumption, no wild jump. The step size in the building block of the basic random walk is always known, namely one step. There is no uncertainty as to the size of the step. We did not encounter situations in which the move varied wildly. Remember that if either of these two central assumptions is not met, your moves, or coin tosses, will not cumulatively lead to the bell curve. Depending on what happens, they can lead to the wild Mandelbrotian-style scale-invariant randomness. The ubiquity of the Gaussian. One of the problems I face in life is that whenever I tell people that the Gaussian bell curve is not ubiquitous in real life, only in the minds of statisticians, they require me to prove it, which is easy to do, as we will see in the next two chapters, yet nobody has managed to prove the opposite. Whenever I suggest a process that is not Gaussian, I am asked to justify my suggestion and to, beyond the phenomena, give them the theory behind it. We saw in Chapter 14 the rich-get-richer models that were proposed in order to justify not using a Gaussian. Modelers were forced to spend their time writing theories on possible models that generate the scalable, as if they needed to be apologetic about it. Theory schmeary. I have an epistemological problem with that, with the need to justify the world's failure to resemble an idealized model that someone blind to reality has managed to promote. My technique, instead of studying the possible models generating non-bell curve randomness, hence making the same errors of blind theorizing, is to do the opposite. To know the bell curve as intimately as I can and identify where it can and cannot hold. I know where Mediocristan is. To me, it is frequently, nay, almost always, the users of the bell curve who do not understand it well and have to justify it, and not the opposite. This ubiquity of the Gaussian is not a property of the world, but a problem in our minds, stemming from the way we look at it. The next chapter will address the scale invariance of nature and address the properties of the fractal. The chapter after that will probe the misuse of the Gaussian in socio-economic life and the need to produce theories. I sometimes get a little emotional because I've spent a large part of my life thinking about this problem. Since I started thinking about it and conducting a variety of thought experiments as I have above, I have not for the life of me been able to find anyone around me in the business and statistical world who was intellectually consistent in that he both accepted the black swan and rejected the Gaussian and Gaussian tools. Many people accepted my black swan idea but could not take it to its logical conclusion, which is that you cannot use one single measure for randomness called standard deviation and call it risk. You cannot expect a simple answer to characterize uncertainty. To go the extra step requires courage, commitment, an ability to connect the dots, a desire to understand randomness fully. It also means not accepting other people's wisdom as gospel. Then I started finding physicists who had rejected the Gaussian tools, but fell for another sin, gullibility about precise predictive models, mostly elaborations around the preferential attachment of Chapter 14, another form of Platonicity. I could not find anyone with depth in scientific technique who looked at the world of randomness and understood its nature, who looked at calculations as an aid, not a principal aim. It took me close to a decade and a half to find that thinker, the man who made many swans gray, Mandelbrot, the great Benoit Mandelbrot. Chapter 16. The Aesthetics of Randomness. Mandelbrot's Library. Was Galileo Blind? Pearls to Swine. Self-Affinity. How the world can be complicated in a simple way, or perhaps simple in a very complicated way. The Poet of Randomness. It was a melancholic afternoon when I smelled the old books in Benoit Mandelbrot's library. This was on a hot day in August 2005, and the heat exacerbated the musty odor of the glue of old French books, bringing on powerful olfactory nostalgia. I usually succeed in repressing such nostalgic excursions, but not when they sneak up on me as music or smell. The odor of Mandelbrot's books was that of French literature, of my parents' library, of the hours spent in bookstores and libraries when I was a teenager, when many books around me were, alas, in French, when I thought that literature was above anything and everything. I haven't been in contact with many French books since my teenage days. However abstract I wanted it to be, literature had a physical embodiment. It had a smell, and this was it. The afternoon was also gloomy because Mandelbrot was moving away, exactly when I had become entitled to call him at crazy hours just because I had a question, such as why people didn't realize that the 80-20 could be 50-1. Mandelbrot had decided to move to the Boston area, not to retire, but to work for a research center sponsored by a national laboratory. Since he was moving to an apartment in Cambridge and leaving his oversized house in the Westchester suburbs of New York, he had invited me to come take my pick of his books. Even the titles of the books had a nostalgic ring. I filled up a box with French titles, such as a 1949 copy of Henri Bergson's Matière et Mémoire, which it seemed Mandelbrot bought when he was a student. The smell. After having mentioned his name left and right throughout this book, I will finally introduce Mandelbrot, principally as the first person with an academic title with whom I ever spoke about randomness without feeling defrauded. Other mathematicians of probability would throw at me theorems with Russian names such as Sobolev, Kolmogorov, Wiener measure, without which they were lost. They had a hard time getting to the heart of the subject or exiting their little box long enough to consider its empirical flaws. With Mandelbrot, it was different. It was as if we both originated from the same country, meeting after years of frustrating exile, and were finally able to speak in our mother tongue without straining. He is the only flesh and bones teacher I ever had. My teachers are usually books in my library. I had way too little respect for mathematicians dealing with uncertainty and statistics to consider any of them my teachers. In my mind, mathematicians, trained for certainties, had no business dealing with randomness. Mandelbrot proved me wrong. He speaks an unusually precise and formal French, much like that spoken by Levantines of my parents' generation, or old-world aristocrats. This made it odd to hear, on occasion, his accented but very standard, colloquial American English. He is tall, overweight, which makes him look baby-faced, although I've never seen him eat a large meal, and has a strong physical presence. From the outside, one would think that what Mandelbrot and I have in common is wild uncertainty, black swans, and dull, and sometimes less dull, statistical notions. But, although we are collaborators, this is not what our major conversations revolve around. It is mostly matters literary and aesthetic, or historical gossip about people of extraordinary intellectual refinement. I mean refinement, not achievement. Mandelbrot could tell stories about the phenomenal array of hotshots he has worked with over the past century, but somehow I am programmed to consider scientists' personae far less interesting than those of colorful erudites. Like me, Mandelbrot takes an interest in urbane individuals who combine traits generally thought not to coexist together. One person he often mentions is Baron Pierre-Jean de Menasse, whom he met at Princeton in the 1950s, where de Menasse was the roommate of the physicist Oppenheimer. De Menasse was exactly the kind of person I am interested in, the embodiment of a black swan. He came from an opulent Alexandrian Jewish merchant family, French and Italian speaking, like all sophisticated Levantines. His forebears had taken a Venetian spelling for their Arabic name, added a Hungarian noble title along the way, and socialized with royalty. De Menasse not only converted to Christianity, but became a Dominican priest and a great scholar of Semitic and Persian languages. Mandelbrot kept questioning me about Alexandria, since he was always looking for such characters. True, intellectually sophisticated characters were exactly what I looked for in life. My erudite and polymathic father, who, were he still alive, would have only been 2 weeks older than Benoit M., liked the company of extremely cultured Jesuit priests. I remember these Jesuit visitors occupying my chair at the dining table. I recall that one had a medical degree and a PhD in physics, yet taught Aramaic to locals in Beirut's Institute of Eastern Languages. His previous assignment could have been teaching high school physics, and the one before that was perhaps in the medical school. This kind of erudition impressed my father far more than scientific assembly line work. I may have something in my genes driving me away from Bildungsphilisters. Although Mandelbrot often expressed amazement at the temperament of high-flying erudites and remarkable but not so famous scientists, such as his old friend Carlton Goiduszek, a man who impressed him with his ability to uncover the causes of tropical diseases, he did not seem eager to trumpet his association with those we consider great scientists. It took me a while to discover that he had worked with an impressive list of scientists in seemingly every field, something a name-dropper would have brought up continuously. Although I have been working with him for a few years now, only the other day, as I was chatting with his wife, did I discover that he spent 2 years as the mathematical collaborator of the psychologist Jean Piaget. Another shock came when I discovered that he had also worked with the great historian Fernand Braudel, but Mandelbrot did not seem to be interested in Braudel. He did not care to discuss John von Neumann, with whom he had worked as a postdoctoral fellow. His scale was inverted. I asked him once about Charles Tresser, an unknown physicist I met at a party who wrote papers on chaos theory and supplemented his researcher's income by making pastry for a shop he ran near New York City. He was emphatic. Un homme extraordinaire, he called Tresser, and could not stop praising him. But when I asked him about a particular famous hotshot, he replied, "He is the prototypical bon élève, a student with good grades, no depth, and no vision." That hotshot was a Nobel laureate. The Platonicity of Triangles. Now, why am I calling this business Mandelbrotian or fractal randomness? Every single bit and piece of the puzzle has been previously mentioned by someone else, such as Pareto, Yule, and Zipf. But it was Mandelbrot who, A, connected the dots, B, linked randomness to geometry, and a special brand at that, and C, took the subject to its natural conclusion. Indeed, many mathematicians are famous today partly because he dug out their works to back up his claims, the strategy I am following here in this book. "I had to invent my predecessors so people take me seriously," he once told me, and he used the credibility of big guns as a rhetorical device. One can almost always ferret out predecessors for any thought. You can always find someone who worked on a part of your argument and use his contribution as your backup. The scientific association with a big idea, the brand name, goes to the one who connects the dots, not the one who makes a casual observation. Even Charles Darwin, who uncultured scientists claim invented the survival of the fittest, was not the first to mention it. He wrote in the introduction of The Origin of Species that the facts he presented were not necessarily original. It was the consequences that he thought were interesting, as he put it with characteristic Victorian modesty. In the end, it is those who derive consequences and seize the importance of the ideas, seeing their real value, who win the day. They are the ones who can talk about the subject. So let me describe Mandelbrotian geometry. The geometry of nature. Triangles, squares, circles, and the other geometric concepts that made many of us yawn in the classroom may be beautiful and pure notions, but they seem more present in the minds of architects, design artists, modern art buildings, and school teachers than in nature itself. That's fine, except that most of us aren't aware of this. Mountains are not triangles or pyramids. Trees are not circles. Straight lines are almost never seen anywhere. Mother Nature did not attend high school geometry courses or read the books of Euclid of Alexandria. Her geometry is jagged, but with a logic of its own and one that is easy to understand. I have said that we seem naturally inclined to platonify and to think exclusively in terms of studied material. Nobody, whether a bricklayer or a natural philosopher, can easily escape the enslavement of such conditioning. Consider that the great Galileo, otherwise a debunker of falsehoods, wrote the following: "The great book of nature lies ever open before our eyes, and the true philosophy is written in it. But we cannot read it unless we have first learned the language and the characters in which it is written. It is written in mathematical language, and the characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures. Was Galileo legally blind? Even the great Galileo, with all his alleged independence of mind, was not capable of taking a clean look at Mother Nature. I am confident that he had windows in his house and that he ventured outside from time to time. He should have known that triangles are not easily found in nature. We are so easily brainwashed. We are either blind or illiterate, or both. That nature's geometry is not Euclid's was so obvious, and nobody, almost nobody, saw it. This physical blindness is identical to the ludic fallacy that makes us think casinos represent randomness. Fractality. But first, a description of fractals. Then we will show how they link to what we call power laws or scalable laws. Fractal is a word Mandelbrot coined to describe the geometry of the rough and broken. From the Latin fractus, the origin of fractured. Fractality is the repetition of geometric patterns at different scales, revealing smaller and smaller versions of themselves. Small parts resemble, to some degree, the whole. I will try to show in this chapter how the fractal applies to the brand of uncertainty that should bear Mandelbrot's name, Mandelbrotian randomness. The veins in leaves look like branches. Branches look like trees. Rocks look like small mountains. There is no qualitative change when an object changes size. If you look at the coast of Britain from an airplane, it resembles what you see when you look at it with a magnifying glass. This character of self-affinity implies that one deceptively short and simple rule of iteration can be used, either by a computer or, more randomly, by Mother Nature, to build shapes of seemingly great complexity. This can come in handy for computer graphics, but more important, it is how nature works. Mandelbrot designed the mathematical object now known as the Mandelbrot set, the most famous object in the history of mathematics. It became popular with followers of chaos theory because it generates pictures of ever-increasing complexity by using a deceptively minuscule recursive rule. Recursive means that something can be reapplied to itself infinitely. You can look at the set at smaller and smaller resolutions without ever reaching the limit. You will continue to see recognizable shapes. The shapes are never the same, yet they bear an affinity to one another, a strong family resemblance. These objects play a role in aesthetics. Consider the following applications. Visual arts. Most computer-generated objects are now based on some version of the Mandelbrotian fractal. We can also see fractals in architecture, paintings, and many works of visual art. Of course, not consciously incorporated by the work's creator. Music. Slowly hum the four-note opening of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Ta-ta-ta-ta. Then replace each individual note with the same four-note opening, so that you end up with a measure of 16 notes. You will see, or rather hear, that each smaller wave resembles the original larger one. Bach and Mahler, for instance, wrote sub-movements that resemble the larger movements of which they are a part. Poetry. Emily Dickinson's poetry, for instance, is fractal. The large resembles the small. It has, according to a commentator, a consciously made assemblage of dictions, meters, rhetorics, gestures, and tones. Fractals initially made Benoit M. a pariah in the mathematical establishment. French mathematicians were horrified. What? Images? Mon Dieu! It was like showing a porno movie to an assembly of devout Eastern Orthodox grandmothers in my ancestral village of Amiens. So Mandelbrot spent time as an intellectual refugee at an IBM research center in upstate New York. It was an FU money situation, as IBM let him do whatever he felt like doing. But the general public, mostly computer geeks, got the point. Mandelbrot's book, The Fractal Geometry of Nature, made a splash when it came out a quarter century ago. It spread through artistic circles and led to studies in aesthetics, architectural design, even large industrial applications. Benoit M. was even offered a position as a professor of medicine. Supposedly, the lungs are self-similar. His talks were invaded by all sorts of artists, earning him the nickname the Rock Star of Mathematics. The computer age helped him become one of the most influential mathematicians in history, in terms of the applications of his work, way before his acceptance by the Ivory Tower. We will see that, in addition to its universality, his work offers an unusual attribute. It is remarkably easy to understand. A few words on his biography. Mandelbrot came to France from Warsaw in 1936 at the age of 12. Owing to the vicissitudes of a clandestine life during Nazi-occupied France, he was spared some of the conventional Gallic education with its uninspiring algebraic drills, becoming largely self-taught. He was later deeply influenced by his uncle Scholem, a prominent member of the French mathematical establishment and holder of a chair at the Collège de France. Benoit M. later settled in the United States, working most of his life as an industrial scientist, with a few transitory and varied academic appointments. The computer played two roles in the new science Mandelbrot helped conceive. First, fractal objects, as we have seen, can be generated with a simple rule applied to itself, which makes them ideal for the automatic activity of a computer, or Mother Nature. Second, in the generation of visual intuitions lies a dialectic between the mathematician and the objects generated. Now let us see how this takes us to randomness. In fact, it is with probability that Mandelbrot started his career. A visual approach to extremistan mediocristan. I am looking at the rug in my study. If I examine it with a microscope, I will see a very rugged terrain. If I look at it with a magnifying glass, the terrain will be smoother, but still highly uneven. But when I look at it from a standing position, it appears uniform. It is almost as smooth as a sheet of paper. The rug at eye level corresponds to mediocristan and the law of large numbers. I am seeing the sum of undulations, and these iron out. This is like Gaussian randomness. The reason my cup of coffee does not jump is that the sum of all its moving particles becomes smooth. Likewise, you reach certainties by adding up small Gaussian uncertainties. This is the law of large numbers. The Gaussian is not self-similar, and that is why my coffee cup does not jump on my desk. Now, consider a trip up a mountain. No matter how high you go on the surface of the earth, it will remain jagged. This is even true at a height of 30,000 feet. When you are flying above the Alps, you will still see jagged mountains in place of small stones. So some surfaces are not from mediocristan, and changing the resolution does not make them much smoother. Note that this effect only disappears when you go up to more extreme heights. Our planet looks smooth to an observer from space, but this is because it is too small. If it were a bigger planet, then it would have mountains that would dwarf the Himalayas, and it would require observation from a greater distance for it to look smooth. Likewise, if the planet had a larger population, even maintaining the same average wealth, we would be likely to find someone whose net worth would vastly surpass that of Bill Gates. Figures 11 and 12 illustrate the preceding point. An observer looking at the first picture might think that a lens cap has fallen on the ground. See the PDF for these images. Recall our brief discussion of the coast of Britain. If you look at it from an airplane, its contours are not so different from the contours you see on the shore. The change in scaling does not alter the shapes or their degree of smoothness. Pearls to swine. What does fractal geometry have to do with the distribution of wealth, the size of cities, returns in the financial markets, the number of casualties in war, or the size of planets? Let us connect the dots. The key here is that the fractal has numerical or statistical measures that are somewhat preserved across scales. The ratio is the same, unlike the Gaussian. Another view of such self-similarity is presented in Figure 13 of the PDF. As we saw in Chapter 15, the super-rich are similar to the rich, only richer. Wealth is scale-independent, or, more precisely, of unknown scale dependence. In the 1960s, Mandelbrot presented his ideas on the prices of commodities and financial securities to the economics establishment, and the financial economists got all excited. In 1963, the then dean of the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business, George Shultz, offered him a professorship. This is the same George Shultz who later became Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State. Shultz called him one evening to rescind the offer. At the time of writing, 44 years later, Nothing has happened in economics and social science statistics, except for some cosmetic fiddling that treats the world as if it were subject only to mild randomness, and yet Nobel medals were being distributed. Some papers were written offering evidence that Mandelbrot was wrong by people who do not get the central argument of this book. You can always produce data corroborating that the underlying process is Gaussian by finding periods that do not have rare events, just like you can find an afternoon during which no one killed anyone and use it as evidence of honest behavior. I will repeat that because of the asymmetry with induction, just as it is easier to reject innocence than accept it, it is easier to reject a bell curve than accept it. Conversely, it is more difficult to reject a fractal than to accept it. Why? Because a single event can destroy the argument that we face a Gaussian bell curve. In sum, 4 decades ago, Mandelbrot gave pearls to economists and resume-building Philistines, which they rejected because the ideas were too good for them. It was, as the saying goes, Margaritas ante porcos, pearls before swine. In the rest of this chapter, I will explain how I can endorse Mandelbrotian fractals as a representation of much of randomness without necessarily accepting their precise use. Fractals should be the default, the approximation, the framework. They do not solve the black swan problem and do not turn all black swans into predictable events, but they significantly mitigate the black swan problem by making such large events conceivable. It makes them gray. Why gray? Because only the Gaussian gives you certainties. More on that later. The logic of fractal randomness, with a warning. Footnote. The non-technical listener can skip from here until the end of the chapter. I have shown in the wealth lists in chapter 15 the logic of a fractal distribution. If wealth doubles from 1 million to 2 million, the incidence of people with at least that much money is cut in 4, which is an exponent of 2. If the exponent were 1, then the incidence of that wealth or more would be cut in 2. The exponent is called the power, which is why some people use the term power law. Let us call the number of occurrences higher than a certain level an exceedance. An exceedance of 2 million is the number of persons with wealth more than 2 million. One main property of these fractals, or another way to express their main property, scalability, is that the ratio of 2 exceedances is going to be the ratio of the 2 numbers to the negative power of the power exponent. Footnote. By using symmetry, we could also examine the incidences below the number. See Table 2 in the PDF for examples of assumed exponents for various phenomena. Let us illustrate this. Say that you think that only 96 books a year will sell more than 250,000 copies, which is what happened last year, and that you think that the exponent is around 1.5. You can extrapolate to estimate that around 34 books will sell more than 500,000 copies. Simply 96 times the quantity of 500,000 over 250,000 to the power of negative 1.5. We can continue, and note that around 12 books should sell more than 1 million copies. Here, 96 times the quantity of 1 million over 250,000 to the power of negative 1.5. Let me show the different measured exponents for a variety of phenomena. Let me tell you up front that these exponents mean very little in terms of numerical precision. We will see why in a minute, but just note for now that we do not observe these parameters. We simply guess them, or infer them for statistical information, which makes it hard at times to know the true parameters, if it in fact exists. Let us first examine the practical consequences of an exponent. Table 3, which you can find in the PDF, illustrates the impact of the highly improbable. It shows the contributions of the top 1% and 20% to the total. The lower the exponent, the higher those contributions. But look how sensitive the process is. Between 1.1 and 1.3, you go from 66% of the total to 34%. Just a 0.2 difference in the exponent changes the result dramatically, and such a difference can come from a simple measurement error. This difference is not trivial. Just consider that we have no precise idea what the exponent is because we cannot measure it directly. All we do is estimate from past data or rely on theories that allow for the building of some model that would give us some idea. But these models may have hidden weaknesses that prevent us from blindly applying them to reality. So keep in mind that the 1.5 exponent is an approximation, that it is hard to compute, that you do not get it from the gods, or at least not easily, and that you will have a monstrous sampling error. You will observe that the number of books selling above 1 million copies is not always going to be 12. It could be as high as 20, or as low as 2. More significantly, this exponent begins to apply at some number called crossover, and addresses numbers larger than this crossover. It may start at 200,000 books, or perhaps only 400,000 books. Likewise, wealth has different properties before, say, $600 million, when inequality grows, than it does below such a number. How do you know where the crossover point is? This is a problem. My colleagues and I worked with around 20 million pieces of financial data. We all had the same data set, yet we never agreed on exactly what the exponent was in our sets. We knew that data revealed a fractal power law, but we learned that one could not produce a precise number. But what we did know, that the distribution is scalable and fractal, was sufficient for us to operate and make decisions. The problem of the upper bound. Some people have researched and accepted the fractal, up to a point. They argue that wealth, book sales, and market returns all have a certain level when things stop being fractal. Truncation is what they propose. I agree that there is a level where fractality might stop, but where? Saying that there is an upper limit but I don't know how high it is, and saying there is no limit carry the same consequences in practice. Proposing an upper limit is highly unsafe. You may say, let us cap wealth at $150 billion in our analyses. Then someone else might say, why not $151 billion? Or why not $152 billion? We might as well consider that the variable is unlimited. Beware the precision. I have learned a few tricks from experience. Whichever exponent I try to measure will be likely to be overestimated. Recall that a higher exponent implies a smaller role for large deviations. What you see is likely to be less black swanish than what you do not see. I call this the masquerade problem. Let's say I generate a process that has an exponent of 1.7. You do not see what is inside the engine, only the data coming out. If I ask you what the exponent is, odds are that you will compute something like 2.4. You would do so even if you had 1 million data points. The reason is that it takes a long time for some fractal processes to reveal their properties, and you underestimate the severity of the shock. Sometimes a fractal can make you believe that it is Gaussian, particularly when the cut point starts at a high number. With fractal distributions, extreme deviations of that kind are rare enough to smoke you. You don't recognize the distribution as fractal. The water puddle revisited.